This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. We have a dog. Her name is Sasha. She's almost four. She's a standard poodle. She's got curly, fluffy, soft black hair, and she's very adorable. And she's a part of our family, and we care a lot about taking good care of her. And that includes feeding her high-quality dog food like Merrick's. Founded in Hereford, Texas, Merrick has been crafting high-quality dog food for over 30 years. Real is Merrick's recipe. They always use deboned meat, fish, or poultry as the number one ingredient. Merrick creates home-style recipes like real Texas beef and sweet potato or Grammy's pot pie, so you can feel good about what you're feeding your pet. I mean, you know, you come home from being out, and your dog is there to greet you, and, like, that's one of the best things about having a pet. You know, you come home, the dog's happy to see you, and they're hungry. And you want to reciprocate that good feeling they give you when you walk in the door. You want to give to them in the form of some high-quality food. So check out Merrick online or in your local pet store and look for their new packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it. Welcome to the third and final story that you wanted to hear this week as part of our 10th anniversary festivities. This one's in two parts. The second part is also up now, and the brand new update comes at the end of that second part. And remember that our Instagram Live 10th anniversary party with Carla Hall and Sola El Whaley is tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Eastern. Sola's going to teach me how to make a roux. Carla and I, we're going to catch up, and we're going to be raising money for Feeding America. Again, tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Eastern. Bring a drink and or a pint of ice cream. Make sure you follow me on Instagram at TheSporkful so you don't miss it. Okay, on with the show. This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people, and we are coming to you live from the Miracle Theater in Washington, D.C. Thank you. That was very good. That was very good. Joining me tonight is a chef who has become well known, not just for his food, but for his story, which we'll be talking about a lot tonight. He worked his way up through all kinds of kitchens, competed on Top Chef, opened his own place. But it's just in the past 6 months that things have really exploded for him. He won the James Beard Award for Rising Star Chef of the Year. He made the 30 under 30 lists of both Zagat and Forbes. And his memoir, Notes from a Young Black Chef, is being turned into a movie starring Lakeith Stanfield from Atlanta. Are you kidding me? Amazing. His restaurants here in D.C. are Kith & Kin and Philly Wing Fry. Please welcome Kwame Onwuachi. So feel free to adjust your mic, make sure it's, you know, close to your face and all that stuff. You've talked into microphones before.
I used to have a rap career. Did you know that?
No.
That wasn't in the book.
Tell me about that. Wow, breaking news.
That's for the next book.
So you really are very comfortable holding a microphone then?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe later on you'll rap for us.
Maybe.
All right, we'll see.
All right, if I get drunk enough tonight.
All right. All right. Well, that's a perfect segue because, you know, I want to begin at the beginning with your story, Kwame. But before we begin at the beginning, I think a good preamble would be to talk about a drink that I learned about from your book called the Nutcracker.
Yeah, those are good.
Tell folks who aren't familiar with what's a Nutcracker.
So a Nutcracker is a hood concoction of a fruity liquid with a spirit in it. And then we usually, like, bottle it and sell it on the street at nighttime. So sometimes they sell it on the beach, but it's usually in the summertime. You sell nutcrackers because everyone's like hanging out outside, and it's delicious. And they don't take ID, so it's great, you know.
And one of your many entrepreneurial periods involved selling nutcrackers.
Yeah. It was
so
good.
I'm reading about this. I mean, this to me sounds like a delicious drink.
It's really good. Yeah.
So I'd like to ask GoFan to come out, please. We prepared a special treat here, Kwame.
Hell yeah. I may be rapping tonight. Hey. Wow, this is great.
Thank you, GoFan. So we have rum and we have Hawaiian punch, per your instructions, chef.
These are key ingredients in a nutcracker.
I went with a classic red Hawaiian punch. I hope that you approve.
That's all right. That's good.
Keep and if you could, I'll let you do the mixology here.
I don't want you to see my recipe, so I'm going to go.
Well,
down.
The book. All right.
Do you want one?
Yeah. Hello.
Oh, this is both for There's me. What happens when my ice melts?
We can get you more ice, buddy. All right. Thank you. Cheers.
Cheers. It's a must. It smells like my childhood.
Oh, that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
My wife would love these.
And your kid probably, too.
Yeah. So let's go back to the beginning. You grew up, at least your early childhood, you're in the Bronx. You grew up, your mom was a caterer. But you come from a long line of chefs and cooks, also your grandmother and your great-grandmother, mm-hmm. right?
So my grandmother had a barbecue spot, a fish fry, and a bar. So in the 50s in the South, it wasn't easy for a person of color to go out to the local bar or, you know, restaurant and have a good time without being harassed. So a lot of people opened up things in the back of their houses, whether it was like a juke joint, a little bar, a restaurant. And my family was the ones that always had restaurants. They were always the entertainers. So my grandmother had that in the South in Ville Platte, Louisiana. You know, my great-grandmother had that as well in like Beaumont, Texas. So yeah, I came from a long line. My mother like ran around those restaurants as a kid. So when she moved to New York City and wanted to provide for her kids, she thought, why don't I start a catering company?
And she like catered for some pretty big celebrities who came through town.
Yeah, yeah. It was pretty cool. I wasn't allowed to go, though, so I never got to meet them. But
you helped cook in the kitchen.
My sister made sure that I knew what I was missing.
But you helped cook in the kitchen.
I helped cook in the kitchen, but I was like 5 years old, so like I couldn't go to the events. So I had to stay home with my babysitter and like a bunch of different ingredients. And that's how I like really got my knack for like creativity with food. I didn't learn how to cook good food until much later in my career.
But you were cooking at 5 or 6 with a babysitter.
Yeah. I made a cake one time. I just mixed flour and water. It wasn't anything crazy and put it in the oven. I made these, I don't know why I have these vivid memories, but like of this fish ball. I thought it was like the most inventive thing. I took the fish and I chopped it up and I just formed it into balls and put flour on the outside of it and fried it. But I didn't take the bones out. So my mom came home and she's like trying to eat it like if you were eating this microphone and like, right. This is good. So some of my earliest creations.
Well, you had nowhere to go but up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. That's I think that's what she thought too. Yeah.
And what about like earliest memory of something your mom made?
Oh, peel and eat shrimp. She always had that. She always used to throw these parties at the house and she would make peel and eat shrimp. So it was like our house spice or like a Cajun spice that she makes in the house and butter, thyme and garlic and Gulf shrimp. And she would just saute that with like some crusty French bread and gumbo. Something that like brought the family together. Anytime we had a family function or it was like a holiday, she would make gumbo, like seafood gumbo with like chicken and andouille sausage, crab, shrimp. And then she used to make every year for my birthday, she would ask me, what do I want for my birthday? And I could only usually get one thing and it would be this fisherman's pie. And it was lobster and crab and crawfish and like a bechamel sauce with like whipped potatoes and Parmesan like bruleed in the oven.
So you had fancy tastes even from a young age.
I mean, a little
That's
bit.
What I'm taking from that.
A little
story.
Bit.
But I love the idea of like 8-year-old Kwame being like, I want lobster pie on my birthday.
Yeah. Yeah. That was me. That was me.
So so there were a lot of good memories in those early years. I know that like, you know, you were in school, you were largely in private school, you mm-hmm. lived in this building that was pretty diverse and you were meeting all different folks in the building, cooking all different kinds of food and your mom's food, but you were also getting into a lot of trouble.
Yeah. It's kind of easy to veer off on the wrong path, you know, when you grow up like where I grew up in the Bronx, the South Bronx. You kind of left your own laurels at a young age, you know, and you have to start taking the train to go to school. And if you like get in with the wrong crowd, it's easy to kind of veer off. And she started noticing that.
And so what'd she do?
she sent me on a vacation. She was like, you're going on a vacation to Nigeria. And I was like, this is amazing. Like, this is great.
So your mom tells you you're going on vacation to Nigeria.
Yeah. So she says, you're going to see your grandfather. So my father is Nigerian and Jamaican. And my mother is Trinidadian and Creole from Louisiana. So she's like, you're going to see your grandfather for a couple weeks. You know, I'll see you in a couple weeks. And I should have known how much she was crying. Like, that it was going to be more than a couple weeks. But I didn't put the two and two together. So I was super excited, you know, kind of arrogant about it too, to my sister for all the years that she like put in my face who they were cooking for at these catering events, you know. And I get on the plane and get there. It's great. It's a culture shock though. It's, you know, we didn't have any electricity, any running water. We weren't in Lagos. We were like in a small village in Delta State. And I quickly learned that it was not a vacation. I think it, you know, it took like 2 months, but.
And you were like going, like, so once a week, your grandfather would drive you like an hour to a call center to call
your
mom.
Yeah, because there were no cell phones then.
Right.
And we had to go to these call centers, like these internet cafes.
Right, right. So after a couple months there, you go to the call center for your weekly call with your mom.
Yeah, I'm like, wait, like, school's about to start, you know, like. It's time for me to come home. I get it, you know. And she was like, you're not coming home, you know. You wouldn't have got on the plane if I told you you were going there to learn respect. And she left me there for 2 years. And
she said, you're not coming back till you learn respect.
Yeah.
What were you thinking when she said that?
I was like, that new Harry Potter movie's coming out. I'm definitely not going to be able to see it. I was trying to see the first thing that went through my head. But I was like, I was really upset because like I knew I was going to have to go to school out there. I had no idea what that was going to be like. I'd heard about from my cousins, like, you know, we would say something where I would talk back or something. And they'd be like, you can't do that in school here. I was like, well, I'm not going to school here. So it doesn't matter, you know. But little did, you know I was.
Were you angry at your mom?
Yeah, absolutely. I was very, very angry and I didn't understand. But it saved my life.
Coming up, Kwame's time in Nigeria changes him. But when he comes back, he still struggles with a lot of the same problems he had before he left. Then later, he ends up on a boat in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. Stick around.
And now, a delicious word from our sponsors.
Mm-mm, it's very good.
A few years back, my friend Justin Warner from Food Network moved out to South Dakota. He opened a ramen joint, and he is always posting pictures of all the great food he's not only cooking, but eating all over South Dakota. He's always telling me to come visit. And you know, one of the best ways to experience a new place is to eat your way through it. But it's equally important to live your way through it, too. And when you summer in South Dakota, you can fill up on all the lake days, hikes, rides, and small-town strolls that'll leave you with a regained sense of wonder and a hunger to do it all over again. See why there's so much South Dakota, so little time at TravelSouthDakota.com. At Boar's Head, delicious is in the details. And you see that in their incredible selection of hummus flavors. Boar's Head hummus is expertly crafted to achieve the perfect balance of creamy texture and refined taste. You can taste those chickpeas, you can taste the tahini, you can taste a little bit of acidity. It's got it all. I especially love their roasted red pepper hummus made with fire-roasted peppers. You can even taste a little bit of that char. It's perfectly dippable. It's perfectly spreadable. This is the kind of thing you always want to have on hand in your refrigerator. Dip, scoop, spread, or smear Boar's Head hummus to your heart's content. Hummus so extraordinary, it can only be Boar's Head. Compromise elsewhere. Famous Amos chocolate chip cookies are so iconic that I just say Famous Amos and it's like I can taste it. Each cookie is filled with semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch. And the word satisfying is very key there because some cookies are crunchy and brittle, and I don't like that. But Famous Amos has a deep, tooth-sinkable, satisfying crunch that I know and love. And Famous Amos classic bite-sized chocolate chip cookies are bringing back the original recipe that everyone knows and loves. One perfect bite, everything classic in a cookie. Find Famous Amos cookies anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
Rack your look for spring at Nordstrom Rack and save up to 60% on brands you love. Rag & Bone, Vince, Marc Jacobs, Adidas, Joe's, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. Score new dresses, denim, sandals, designer bags, and sunglasses, plus updates for the family and home.
Get your spring on for less, up to 60% less, today at your Nordstrom Rack store. What will you find?
Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman. Check out our recent episode about the Queen's Night Market. It's a very different place from those high-end food halls and festivals because vendors there can't sell anything for more than $5. So fancy chefs tend to stay away. Instead, the people who cook there do it to share a piece of their culture and themselves, and often to try to get their own culinary businesses off the ground. In this episode, we hear vendors' stories in their own words. When Frances Roman came out at 15, her mom kicked her out of the house. Now, Frances runs a popular stand at the night market, and her mom's her number one helper.
Every night, I had lines of just queer people. And it's even crazy because they come back looking for my mother. And I'm like, huh? They love my mom.
Of course, because of coronavirus, the Queen's Night Market hasn't opened this year. So this episode isn't just about the vendors. It's also about what we've all lost in this pandemic. I really hope you'll check it out. It's called The World Eats Here. It's up now wherever you got this one. Now let's get back to my conversation with Chef Kwame Onwuachi, taped live on stage in D.C. And a quick note that there is some explicit language in the first few minutes of this next section. At the end of Kwame's summer in Nigeria, instead of returning home to the U.S. as he'd expected, he started school in Nigeria. And he quickly learned that discipline in school there was very different from what it is here.
So if you don't do your homework over here, you know, nothing really happens to you. But over there, if you don't do your homework, you have to carry a cinder block across the soccer field 6 times.
Yeah. So did you do your homework?
After that one time, yeah. I didn't really, I was like, I've heard about it. I'm like, no way. Like,
right.
Where do they, first of all, do they just keep cinder blocks on there? Like, where, I've never seen a cinder block since I've been in this school. So there's no way they're making us do this.
Right.
But they did. They definitely did. And the whole school can see you. So you have to do that. And then, you know, if you get into a fight here in America, you get suspended, you know, or expelled. Over there, if you get into a fight, you have to dig your own height. And that takes like, a long like time.
Dig a hole the depth of how tall you are.
Dig a hole and constantly jump in to see if you cannot see over. And you jump in and you're like, fuck, man, I gotta get back.
Did you have to do that one?
Hell no, I wasn't fighting. The cinder block was enough for me. Yeah. I was good. We're not fighting. Here's my lunch. Do whatever you want.
What about the food in Nigeria?
The food took some getting used to. I mean, I grew up eating Nigerian food, you know, or West African food. But the classics, like egusi stew and, you know, red stew and pepper soup and moi moi and things like that. But, like, having a bowl of, like, okra soup that's just, like, pure okra and, like, pounded yam. We had onion stew in the morning over rice to a 10-year-old. You know, American kid, it was tough. I didn't really eat for the first month. I ate peanuts. They had ground nuts that they sold all on the side of the street and these like cheese doodle things called cheesies. And I ate that for a month straight.
But did you eventually?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Eventually, I got real hungry. And one morning, that onion stew started smelling really good. And I took a bite of it and I was like, why wasn't I eating this whole time? You know, and, you know, even the okra stew, it was great. And I think for me, it was like really cool because once I learned how they were made too, it made me more interested because we had to, you know, if we made like banga stew, which is like from the palm kernel and you boil the palm kernel and you kind of like beat it in a mortar and pestle, like a giant mortar and pestle, and it turns into like a paste. And then you pass that paste through like a some sort of strainer, fine mesh strainer, and then you make your sauce from that. So, like, it was cool going and getting the palm kernels and then making the dish, right? So it taught me this appreciation for food that I never knew before, even raising my own chickens. You know, at a certain point, I used to think back, like, man, if I wanted, like, a 20-piece wing basket, I just go to KFC or the chicken spot and get that. Here, I have to raise 10 chickens and it takes like 5 months, you know? So like, there was like hard lessons learned, you know? Fighting for chicken wings were like a thing and I never got them. I was the youngest.
but it made me appreciate every part of food. And I think that directly translates into my career and what I do now.
So after 2 years in Nigeria, you come back. Did you learn respect?
No, I was still a piece of shit, kid. Yeah. I mean, I put on a good front for like a month. Like, yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. You know? And then I was a teenager and I got right back into the same things that, you know, got me sent out there in the first place.
Right. So you kind of fall in with a not great crowd. You go to college. Yeah. You start off selling nutcrackers in college, which seems harmless enough. But then you move from there on to selling real drugs.
Yeah.
And eventually you got kicked out of college for selling drugs. And then you go through this period where you're not just selling drugs, but also doing a lot of drugs. You talk in the book about this morning you woke up and like, we can get to it, you cooked something, but you said it was like the first time and you couldn't remember how long you didn't start the day with a handful of pills.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because, I mean, I think a lot of us go through a period when we're young of sort of aimlessness. But I think that there's a difference between being aimless and being self-destructive.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think was pushing you in that direction?
I mean, I went to school with $20 in my pocket and I invested in a bottle of rum and Hawaiian Punch. You know, as soon as I got there. And I did that so I can eat while I was in school and help pay for my tuition. And then I kind of got addicted to that like fast lifestyle. You know, then I was like, I want to sell this. And then, okay, if I can sell that, then I can sell this. And then I became known on campus as a guy that just sold things, you know. So I got addicted to that. And then I kind of lost myself in that. It was like, you know, I was selling it. So then I started doing more than I was selling. And then once there was no more, then I had to like kind of go back home, you know? And I think it was a subconscious like thought of like, maybe if I just like run out of everything, I'll have to like kind of start fresh and really find out who I am. You know, I inflicted that on myself so that I could reset. But it was really, even with that going on, I remember seeing Obama walk across the stage and win the election. And I just never thought he was going to win. I mean, just because like he's a black man in America. And, you know, 50 years ago, like I don't think we could play golf in certain places and stuff. So I was just like, this isn't going to happen. And I still voted for him and I was hopeful. And when it happened, I was just like, what am I doing right now? This person, like, you know, 50 years ago, we couldn't eat in the same restaurants. And now he is the president of the United States. Why can't I do anything that I put my mind to? So at that moment, yes, I was still like heavily doing drugs, but I threw away everything that I had. I gave away the things that I could give away, and I bought a one-way plane ticket to Louisiana.
Which is where your mom had moved.
Yeah.
And that was when you sort of went to Louisiana. You said, I'm going to kind of come down here, dry out, try to embark on a career as a chef. And you end up on a boat.
Mm-hmm.
This is right after you guys remember the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. So they were sending, there were all these cleanup crews on all these boats and they need to feed the workers on the boats. So they were desperately looking for chefs to work these boats. And despite the fact that at this point, you didn't have a whole lot of experience.
No, so the thing is, I didn't even go down there to be a chef. I went down there to be a rapper.
Oh, see, this is the part that was left out of the memoir.
I knew I was going to make it. We only had a couple, you know, so many pages. We can't get into everything. But no, I went down there and I was going to do the music thing. And, you know, the only job I can get was in restaurants. It was the one job that I can like literally walk into and like jump into just like that. So I worked in the dining room. I worked in the kitchen. I worked as a dishwasher when I first moved down there. And I was just like kind of still hustling. Chasing that high of making money. The first job I got, I was making $20 a day as a waiter. And it was like horrible going from making like $4,000 a week to $20 a day.
$4,000 a week as a drug dealer.
Exactly.
Right.
And with the Deepwater Horizon, it came around because there was a temporary temp at the place I was working. And he only worked, you know, 1 week. And then I wouldn't see him for like 3 weeks. And I was like, where do you go? We're like, what are you doing? And he was like, oh, I'm on the Gulf of Mexico, man. It's amazing. He's like, yeah, we get to cook. Like, it's me, another chef. We make like, you know, $1,900 a week. We can order whatever we want and we can just cook for like 30 people. I was like, how much did you say you make? And he was like, $1,900 a week. I was like, can you send me the application? Because like, I really want to cook for these people. I think it'd be really great to, you know, devote my time to these, you know,
saints.
These patriots that are saving the waters and our Gulf.
Right.
So I applied. I got the job because they were hiring anyone to go out there because it was like cooking for pirates. It was crazy. So we had to drive to like Houma, Louisiana, like the little strings that you see on the map. You like that's where we were driving. Like the road was like as big as a stage and there was just water on each side. It was very scary, actually.
I picture it like it's like driving to the end of the earth.
Yeah, that's what it felt like, you know, and my mom drove me down and she was like, you sure you want to do this? Like, you know, we got there and she was just like, you know, this is going to make you or break you. I know, like, you don't know if you want to be a chef or not, but you're not going to have any, there's no internet service out there. You can't just look up recipes. You have to cook from the heart. People are going to tell if you can actually cook or not.
When you first got on the boat, like, set the scene. Like, you take, like, a shuttle boat out
you
to the
You take a shuttle
insane,
boat like, 3 hours into the Gulf of Mexico. And then it's, like, at nighttime. There's only, like, a swing rope to get to the other boat. So I have to, like, literally, shit. All right. And they're like, oh, no, wait. Let me try again, you know? And then you swing over. You jump down. They throw your luggage, you know?
Oh, my
These, God. Like, crazy looking
it's
guys.
Like some Peter Pan shit.
Yeah, seriously. Are on there. They're, you know, they're there helping you. Like you jump into their arms and, you know, then they catch your luggage and put it down. And it was very, very scary for me.
And
never
and
being
and
in the
get
middle
there,
of the ocean.
Who are the other people on the boat?
They're like these really country looking Caucasian people. Yeah.
And when you see that, what are you thinking?
I'm like, this isn't going to work out. Like, this is not going to work out. This isn't going to end well. Had the movie Get Out come out before, I may have had some sort of insight to what was going to happen. But I had to use my imagination.
Right.
I remember the first question the chef asked me. He was like, do you know how to read? And I was like, excuse me? And he was like, I have a lot of people like you that come on this boat that don't know how to read. So
when he said like you, he meant?
He meant people that wear hoodies. No, he meant black person.
Okay.
Yeah, he meant a black person. And I was like, this conversation's over. You're just going to cook your food. I'm going to cook my food. I'm not going to be your sous chef or anything like that. And that's it. I'll probably only do 3 weeks because I'll be fired after this. So, and I'm just like, what am I doing? You know? The money is never worth it, you know? And I start cooking. And I start cooking things that my mom taught me how to cook. You know, red beans and rice, jambalaya, shrimp etouffee, gumbo. And the people that were on the boat were from Louisiana. They were just from the back country of Louisiana. So, like, they would come down and smell things and say, like, what are you making? And I'm like, oh, I'm making, you know, chicken fricassee or I'm making etouffee or catfish achafalaya. And they're like, I cannot wait for dinner, you know? And they would eat in the galley, you know, I think that's what they call the kitchen, was just like silent, just like this, silent. You just heard like the forks and knives clanking. And you would see them like, I'm not eating breakfast. Who's cooking? Is Tex cooking breakfast? I'm not eating. I'm waiting for lunch, you know? And that's how it starts. So when I went on my my 1 week break, I thought I was never going to get invited back because I had clearly disrespected the head chef of the boat, you know, saying I'm going to cook my own food. And when I got back, he wasn't there anymore. There was another guy.
When you got back to onto the boat for a second time?
Yeah, after my week off. And I was like, where's Tex? And they were like, we asked him not to come back. We just want your food. So that's when I knew I had something. You can clap. It's okay. Don't let it go on. It's all right. Thank you. Yeah. It's for the podcast, you know. Yeah. We got to make it seem exciting. Just cut the part out when I asked them to clap.
Okay? Yeah, no, that was
because we
that
don't
was
want
totally
that.
Organic.
I don't want to look like that guy.
Yeah. So when you realized they had asked you back because they loved your food so much, how did that feel?
It felt great. It felt extremely validating, and I got like bit by this bug of like, oh, I want to cook more because it's making people happy. You know, I wasn't getting any extra bonus points. I wasn't in the press. You know, I wasn't in the Gulf News or anything like that. I was just like, I was just cooking for people and they were like, this is good. Thank you. And this feeling that I got, I wanted more of it. Mainly I gained this connection to someone that I thought I would never gain a connection to on that boat. You know, a group of people that I thought clearly were racist, and I don't know if they were or not or weren't, but I knew that we bonded over something and it was a plate of food.
After that experience on the ship in the Gulf, Kwame's life had a new direction. But a lot still had to happen before he'd get to the James Beard Award and the movie based on his life. In part two of our conversation, Kwame talks his way into a big break. He meets a woman who mentions she needs a caterer, and he responds,
"You never asked me what I do." And she's like, "What do you mean?" I was like, "I'm a caterer." And she's like, "You're a caterer?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm a caterer." She's like, "How old are you?" I was like, "Ma'am, that is irrelevant. You know, what catering services do you need?"
Plus, Kwame talks about dealing with racism in high-end kitchens and trying to run his own restaurant without giving in to his worst impulses. Part two is up now, and it includes a brand new update. If you're enjoying the special episodes we're sharing this week, I hope you'll spread the word on social media. Tell your friends to check us out. And please, take a minute right now and make sure you subscribe to our podcast in Apple Podcasts, follow us in Spotify, Favorite, and Stitcher, whatever the thing is in your app. That way you can stay connected to us and hear future episodes, like our next one about the enslaved man who taught Jack Daniel how to make whiskey. One more reminder, Instagram Live 10th Anniversary Party with Sola El Whaley and Carla Hall. Tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Eastern. Bring a drink and or a pint of ice cream. I'll be bringing both. This episode was produced by Emma Morgenstern and Gofanan Putubwele. It was edited by Tracy Samuelson and mixed by Jared O'Connell. Music help from Black Label Music. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher. Our executive producers are Chris Bannon and Daisy Rosario. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Catherine Downey from Missoula, Montana, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.